The following podcast contains explicit language.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
Leave my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud.
What's in the box?
Hello, and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Forrest Wickman, Slate's culture editor, and today we're spoiling the movie that no one asked for, which is another Star Wars prequel, Solo, A Star Wars Story. Here to talk with me about the film, our Slate editorial assistant, Marissa Martinelli. Hey, Marissa.
Hello, Forrest.
And Slate browbeat editor, Sam Adams. Hey, Sam.
Hello.
So Sam and I, we saw this like a week and a half ago, and we're just commenting that it has gone completely out of our heads. Sam, I know a little bit about what you think because you already reviewed it for Slate. Marissa, I know very little about what you think of this movie, so I'm very curious. Would you send people to the latest Star Wars film?
I saw this movie 2 days ago, and it is already going out of my head, but I would absolutely send people to this movie. It was Ooh. Forgettable, but it was so much fun.
And Sam, based on review, well, I don't know. You were certainly more negative on it than just about any other Star Wars movie. Nonetheless, would you send people?
I would probably send them properly prepared. Yes. I mean, I kind of enjoyed it when I was watching it and then found myself kind of getting angrier and angrier at it as I thought about it more and just its complete, like, lack of any compelling reason to exist. But I didn't not enjoy myself while I was watching it. So that's my recommendation, such as it is.
Yeah, I also mostly enjoyed this movie. I think I was more underwhelmed by it than I have ever been by any Star Wars movie, which it's a little hard for me to separate that from the fact that I saw the prequels as a tween and then a teenager and, you know, full disclosure, was first in line at my local multiplex for tickets for The Phantom Menace. So, but nonetheless, like, I found it kind of difficult to hate or to love. Starting, frankly, right from the first, I don't know, 5 seconds of this movie where, you know, any Star Wars movie, usually you can count on it to at least start with a bang, with the big brass burst.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, there is no brass burst, and it just goes straight to the whimper of, I believe it says, it was a lawless time. And then there is no Star Wars scroll, and then we meet the young version of our hero. Marissa, what was our hero up to? Finally, we can find out what Han was up to 20 years before the first Star Wars movie.
Well, Han was making trouble on the planet of Corellia. We find out that even as a young man, he's working for a crime boss, in this case, Lady Proxima.
Who's like a giant worm kind of thing voiced by Linda Hunt.
Yeah, she kind of reminded me of who is the hookah-smoking caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland?
So. Yeah, but why? Explain yourself. Just in physical appearance.
I guess, wasn't Lady Proxima basically just a giant, slightly menacing caterpillar? Although I concede that this caterpillar was not smoking hookah. Nonetheless, it was like a many-legged creature standing upright with our hero cowering before it.
I guess I thought of her as more of like aquatic, since she is submerged in a pool of water and has an aversion to light. But I'll take that under advisement.
That's true. And we do get a good bit here, I think. Sam, I know you agree with this, that the thermal detonator bit here is one of the better bits in the movie, and B, one of the kind of rare glimpses of what must have been this movie as it was originally intended by directors Phil Lord and Chris Miller, you know, who also did the Lego movie and did the surprisingly great 21 Jump Street movies and originally directed this movie before it was taken away from them by Disney and given to Ron Howard. And so we get this bit where Solo, you know, in classic fashion, being somebody who pretends to be a swaggering rogue, but is actually just a goober, picks up a rock.
Hat tip, Laura Bradley.
Yes. If anybody would like to read more about how Han Solo is a goober, I refer them to a Laura Bradley post on Slate from a couple years ago. Solo picks up a rock and just basically pretends it's a thermal detonator, fooling absolutely no one.
And then Lady Proxima says, "That's just a rock, and you made a clicking noise with your mouth." Which is right. The real sort of like Lord Miller, like meta movie. Like, not only does he do this ridiculous thing, but then someone is like, you just did this ridiculous thing that no one believes. And then somehow that's like actually his plan for her to notice that. And then he like throws it through the window and it breaks and she's allergic to sunlight or something. But yeah,
she's like a vampire all of a sudden.
Yes. But that is one of the moments that feels very like has that sort of Lord Miller level of kind of like meta sort of self-awareness winking at itself thing, which the movie, I mean, I can imagine 2 hours of 2 hours and however many minutes of that would have gotten pretty tiresome, but it's
it would have been Guardians of the Galaxy, right? And right. As is, I feel like this movie kind of gets out Guardians of the Galaxy by Outgard. Sorry,
by Outgardens of the Out Galaxy. Yes,
I agree with Sam though. I think they said that about 30% of Lord Miller's contribution stayed in the film, and I would bet money that the first few sequences were the Lord Miller sequences because they were very self-referential and winky, and I think that might have gotten old really quick.
I mean, it is hard to tell in some ways because, I mean, Ron Howard really kind of came into the middle of the production, and I think there was one role that was recast. Paul Bettany, who plays the villain in this movie, whose name is Dryden Voss. That was originally going to be a motion capture character played by Michael K. Williams, who's best known as Omar on The Wire. When they reworked the schedule after Ron Howard took over, he was not able to turn up. So Paul Bettany, who had worked with Ron Howard on some of the Da Vinci Code movies, I guess, sort of kind of filled in instead. Other than that, there's, I think, a lot of almost total continuity with when Lord and Miller were shooting it, including retaining the same cinematographer, Bradford Young, and obviously the sets and things were already built. So it's not immediately obvious when you're looking at any one scene, for the most part, whether this is a Ron Howard scene or a Lord Miller scene. And that 30% estimate is kind of, who knows how accurate that is or how it's actually calculated. And it's possible that, you know, some of the stuff that Lord Miller shot was some of the action sequences, which it would make sense to shoot first, and those don't have a huge flavor to them to begin with.
Yeah, which is too bad. I mean, what you want from them is the humor, and they're, I don't know, the action sequences in Lego Movie are totally serviceable, but that's not what people remember the Lego Movie for, or the 21 Jump Street movies. And so it's kind of too bad that most of the humor in this really fell flat at our screening. I don't know if it was the same case in your screening, Marissa, but it really jumped out at me during one moment when it was very clear that the characters were laughing at each other's jokes mm-hmm. more than the audience was, which is never a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign. And some of those moments of humor, especially in the beginning before the tone of the movie had sort of been established, really fell flat in our screening. I mean, the thermal detonator gag, I think, is got the loudest laugh of the entire movie. And it comes very, very early on.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, so before we get to Dryden Voss, we also have to get to our love interest for this movie. It starts very much kind of like in medias relationship, which I found made it a little hard to really care about this relationship. We don't really see like what brought them together in the first place. And so I didn't have a great sense of either their chemistry or what is supposed to make Kira appealing. Kira, we should say, is played by Emilia Clarke. So, Sam, where are Solo and Kira when we first meet them?
They are, I think the suggestion is that they grew up together as orphans or something. This feels a little bit like one of the scenes in A Christmas Prince where you see her like writing the notes. It's just like orphans or something? Question mark. those would basically be my notes from this movie if I took those sort of notes.
I think it was more explicit than that actually, because just before we see them together, there's a scene with a bunch of little British children who are like street rats. And they're fighting over who knows what. And one of them's like, it belongs to me because I'm holding it. Yeah. And I thought that was sort of the idea was then we pan over to Han and Kira, and we get the idea that, like, that's how they grew up.
Yeah. So they've certainly, like, grown up together on the streets, the mean streets of Corellia. And actually, that opening not crawl that you mentioned, but the right. opening text actually uses the word mean streets. Mm-hmm. Which is like a Raymond Chandler reference and would like
could
what
be
that's,
Scorsese too.
Yeah, what that's what either of those things would be doing in this movie is a complete mystery. Yeah. It is neither Chandlerian nor Scorsesean nor any other sorts of Ians. excuse me. But yes, anyway, so they have grown up together on the mean streets of Corellia, and they are involved in a heist, which Han once again kind of ends up in hock to this kind of slimy invertebrate creature. He's just got a type, obviously, and it is going to be enough to smuggle them off this world, which is sort of not exactly a, you know, prison planet or something, but is clearly like you need some sort of pull or the money to bribe somebody in order to cross the border, which is one of the few moments when this movie actually feels like it's being made. Now there's this big scene at the beginning where they are trying to basically, you know, sort of illegally emigrate off Corellia, and they are Han makes it out. The door is shut before Kira can go out. And then there's this sequence where Han decides to join the Imperial Army. Just, he needs money. He wants to learn how to fly, and that's the most obvious place to it. And that was a moment watching the movie where it's like, oh, this is interesting. Like, we're actually going to get some stuff that we haven't seen before. And then it's just smash cut to, and there's a caption that says 3 years later, and Han is like crawling through the mud, and it's, you know, sort of Full Metal Jacket for about 30 seconds. And then he's like, find some other soldier played by, or someone posing as a soldier played by Woody Harrelson, and they're pulling off another heist, and he's back doing his old thing with them. So that, to me, is so emblematic of what this movie is doing, which is just kind of pretending, or keeps kind of like toying with the idea of doing something a little bit different. Even the way that opening text just sort of looks like a crawl, but isn't actually a crawl. And they made a big deal with Rogue One about how this is the first Star Wars movie without a crawl. And then with this one, they're kind of like, well, what if not a crawl, but words? so it's, you know, that sort of trying to very, very vaguely do something different, but actually making sure that the fans don't get mad at you is kind of the heart and soul of this movie to me. I mean, that is really what it is trying to do. And, you know, it is successful at kind of, you know, hitting the right buttons and pleasing you in the way it intends to please you. But it also is just, I was so aware watching that, you know, no risks are being taken, and every fan service that can be serviced is serviced.
Yeah, I think there is, like, in that brief sequence where Solo is, I guess, enlisting in the army, there is both yet another, like, potentially sort of political moment, which is the fact that, I guess, their stormtroopers keep saying, do not resist, which is one of those things that probably would have been in any Star Wars movie made at any time, and yet at this precise moment in history feels like, maybe sort of that is an attempt at trying to be a little more timely. And there's also another, I think, kind of rare moment of personality and knowingness that really works in this movie. It might be another Phil Lord and Chris Miller thing where, as you mentioned in your review, Sam, we see like a recruitment video for the Imperial Army. And as part of the recruitment video, they're playing the Imperial March from the original Star Wars films. So,
yeah, but at a slightly more kind of like upbeat, like major key rendition. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the few good and one of the few like actually underplayed jokes in the movie, where there isn't like Bugs Bunny leading into frame with a sign that says joke.
Yeah. So, okay. Solo, he's gone into the army. And
now,
then he's
now
trying
he's
to
actually named Solo.
Oh, right. We haven't.
We all collectively tried to forget.
Speaking of mugging at the camera. So one of the biggest problems of this movie, and one reason I think it really does suffer from, you know, prequelitis, is that it just tries to give the origin story for like every little aspect of, you know, Han Solo arcana, and even things that you just never would have cared about or a question you never would have thought to ask. So, for example, it gives you the origin of his surname,
right,
which I think logically most of us just assumed was his surname. I don't know if there's anything from the larger Star Wars universe, but Marissa, how do we at last discover the origin of Han Solo's surname?
Well, up until the escape from Corellia, he's just Han, the character. And then it's when he goes to the recruitment, you know, sort of facility for the Empire that he's asked, you know, what's your name? And he says, Han. And the recruiter says, you know, who are your people? What else? Which, first of all, is very strange because there are tons of people in the Star Wars universe with only one name. But this is an excuse for him to say, I have no people. I'm alone. And the recruiter gives him the last name Solo, which was just so, I mean, I groaned aloud.
And they really
jumped.
He's like, Han.
Han Loner?
Solo. Yeah.
Han No Friends?
Han Alone Guy? No. Yes. And it's just, I mean, it's like literally if you came up with the stupidest possible explanation of how Han Solo got his name, that's the actual scene in this movie.
But I hate this because part of the fun of the original Star Wars is that everyone has these names that are so literal. I mean, Darth Vader is just Invader with the N chopped off.
And Luke Skywalker.
Or father.
But yeah,
Luke it's just
Skywalker.
A place where people have names like Skywalker and Solo, and that's normal.
Yes, I found this very demythologizing.
Well, and then I think it's around this time where we get another version of this, which is so Han Solo, now Solo, meets for the first time Chewbacca. I think it's in the muck of this kind of World War I-ish trench warfare scene, because I distinctly remember that Chewbacca has the precise look of a wet dog, where he looks like kind of surprisingly bony in a way that any furry animal does when they're wet. And so then they start talking and you kind of get a little bit of how their language works. And then Chewbacca gives his name. And then Han Solo says, I'm going to get the exact quote so we get the full clunkiness.
You must do justice to the elegance of the screenwriting here. Yeah.
He says, you're going to need a nickname because I ain't saying that every time.
Three syllables too long.
Was born the nickname. The famous immortal nickname of Chewie.
Yeah, and it's like, has anyone ever watched a Star Wars movie and be like, huh, I wonder why Han calls Chewbacca Chewie?
Well, this movie's full of it. I mean, especially with the names, they really lay into this. Later down the line, when we finally meet Lando Calrissian, who we'll get to, their first interaction is all about the introduction between them. And Lando says, oh, Han Solo?
Yeah.
Which, of course, he does in later movies. But did anyone really need an explanation for that? I definitely did not.
I thought that was at least a sort of, like, kind of funny wink and retcon. Like, you know, I feel like Star Wars fans for decades have puzzled over the proper pronunciation of Han because nobody quite gets it right. And George Lucas didn't care enough about dialogue or acting to really, like, preserve continuity when it came to things like this.
Well,
so,
sure, but I
sort of like that as a little bit of an in-joke, the way that, like, the prequels kind of, like, because famously in the first movie, they say that Han Solo did the Kessel Run in under 12 parsecs, and the parsec is actually a unit of distance, not speed. And then there are later movies where they correct that, and then I think in the prequels, George Lucas uncorrected it. And it's like, no, actually, the parsec is a unit of speed in this universe. Go fuck yourself.
Something very relevant.
Which is the right answer. Yes. Like, the Star Wars is supposed to be silly. It does not, there's nothing about Star Wars that has ever been scientifically accurate. You can't hear explosions in space either. But, like, we hear them in Star Wars. I don't know. The idea of making Star Wars into hardcore sci-fi is just misunderstands the whole spirit of Star Wars.
I agree, but I think that the in-jokes to fans, I think we're doing the writers a disservice by giving them a pass on jokes like, oh, this is how Solo got his name. This is why Chewie's called Chewie. Because there are moments in this movie that are fun references to other movies. For example, when Han first meets Chewbacca, it's in the context of him, he's accused of deserting the Empire, and he's tossed into basically a monster's lair. And it's very evocative of the scene with the Rancor. In fact, I think people in my screening were like, oh, it must be the Rancor. And then as the monster emerges from the shadows, it's Chewbacca. That's very funny, because Chewbacca is basically a giant monster walking around, but they're friends. And I thought nods like that were much smarter and more fun.
And one of the things I like that they didn't explain is that the kind of the tension in that sequence is resolved because they basically thrown Han into this pit to get, you know, killed by this Wookiee monster. And the tension is resolved by the fact that, like, Han speaks Wookiee. And there's no explanation of that. And I love that there's no explanation of that, actually. It's just like, he's been around. He grew up on the streets, you know, and he's just like, he speaks it very badly. Mm-hmm. But it is actually subtitled in the movie for, I think, the first time. And then he says to Chewbacca, like, hey, let's pretend to have a fight and actually, like, knock out the supports of this thing and, like, get the people who are, get the guards upstairs, and then we'll both escape together. And I sort of liked
a lot. And the translation is specifically this sort of, like very non-native it's English, like where it's like me pretend fight you, which is good. I think any examples where there are any instances of this kind of thing where they're actually leaning into the silliness and trying, like, instead of trying to explain the silliness, just like making it even more nonsensical, I think that those bits are generally pretty good. Okay, so I think this movie from here on out primarily consists of two heist sequences with two slightly different crews. And here is when Han Solo meets the first crew. Marissa, who is in this crew?
In this crew is Woody Harrelson's Tobias Beckett, who we are told, if not actually shown, is a sort of notorious bounty hunter type.
Which is actually, now that we've been talking about names, like an oddly straightforward, just like very English name for a Star Wars character.
True.
I'm not really sure how he got his name. I look forward to his origin story.
His wife has a very ordinary name too. She's Sandy Newton's character is Val Beckett.
Right.
And they are joined by
The Becketts, Tobias and Val. Yes.
Dinner at the Becketts. They are joined by a not very ordinary character named Rio Durant.
Is that the Jon Favreau character?
That is the Jon Favreau character.
He's a four-armed CGI pilot, right?
Right.
It's kind of monkey-ish.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
With a couple extra arms. And also he talks.
Sort of jokey. And
kind of the Rocket Raccoon of this movie, but without being, I don't know, I found him pretty forgettable.
He's got that sort of generic, like Hollywood Queens accent that they like to do when they want to sort of signify the class that characters are working
right.
class. hey, I'm gonna fly you guys in this plane now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess he's like, maybe the joke is sort of that they took a grease monkey, and in this case, he's like a literal monkey, except for with a couple extra space arms, and Chewie and Solo, they like manage to join into this group. They kind of reluctantly take them on board.
Mm-hmm.
And then thus begins the great train robbery of the first great train robbery in a Star Wars movie. Sam, why don't you walk us through that sequence?
Coaxium.
Yes. Well, this is they are trying to rob a shipment of coaxium, which is kind of the all-purpose widget in this movie. It's basically a fuel.
Unobtainium.
Yes.
Vibranium.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. It is the fuel thing that everybody wants. The sequence also, I think, not introduces, but was, I think, the first time you get a real glimpse of Enfys Nest, who is kind of the secondary antagonist of this movie. It's kind of another, the rogue's rogue who, you know, steals, is basically waiting for them to pull off this daring heist, and then will come and steal that from them. And in fact, does, you know, manage to successfully foil it, although they end up just blowing up this coaxium instead of actually stealing it. And then Ton once again is sort of in debt to a creature, as he so often ends up doing. We lose Tandy Newton's character in the course of the sequence as well. She dies.
And Jon Favreau.
Yes.
It's a bloodbath.
And yes, it is. Yes.
Isn't, again, this is the second movie in which this has happened recently. Isn't Val the first person to die? Like, in other words, the black character is the first to die? Or, I mean, maybe the Jon Favreau character dies first.
No, I think she dies first because he dies. Yeah, she gets blown up. And then, yeah, so she is, as Tandy Newton has been pointing out, she's kind of the first, like, dark-skinned woman in the Star Wars universe. And she does not last very long. I mean, she brings, like, a great kind of presence to the movie that I miss, because she is just a real, she plays the character as a real kind of, you know, hard-edged, just a real kind of battle-hardened woman who's just been through a ton of shit and is, you know, and is not...
she's very no-nonsense.
She's very no-nonsense. She does not have this kind of like roguish swagger that everybody else does. She's just kind of all business. And even when it turns out that she has to, she eventually kind of, you know, blows herself up to save the others. And it's just like, well, this is the thing that I have to do now. I'm going to do it. So long.
It's been real, she says, or something like that. Or it's been a blast or something like that.
The movie seems to just keep expecting us to like really care about these new characters who we just met and don't. I mean, I agree. She was good in it. Right. Well, so I think after I saw this movie and before you saw it, Marissa, we were talking about it, and you mentioned one reason you were excited about it was to like see the first I don't know, woman,
major black female character
in a Star Wars movie. I guess like one who is not just doing motion capture might be the distinction with like Lupita Nyong'o,
right?
As Maz Kanata in the new movies. And I just kind of like, I think I did a terrible job, but I tried to keep a little bit of a poker face, or what is the equivalent of poker in this movie?
A sabacc face,
because if this movie wanted any points for this, it does not deserve them, in my estimation. I don't know how you felt about this.
No, I think, I mean, even with Jon Favreau's character, they were both, I think I was expecting this to be the core crew of the movie. And yeah, for both of those characters to be killed off so soon was very surprising. I would have liked to see more Val Beckett. This movie, in terms of the greater picture of women in Star Wars, introduced some really interesting characters. And she turned out not to be even the main female character. Right. We had Emilia Clarke as Kira. We had my favorite, the only female droid in a Star Wars movie. One small step for droid kind. But
who's named Leet? Right? Or do they call her L337?
I don't know if they ever say like L337. They call her L3 for sure.
L3, yeah. Right. Which I assume is some sort of like joke or reference to Leet speak.
That would be my guess, yeah.
Which, for listeners who are not aware, is like the term for a type of slang in video gaming where basically you just like replace all of the vowels with numbers, I think, is essentially how it works. And there are some other things. And anyway, Leet is how it's spelled, L337.
So instead of calling someone a noob, you call them an N00B, stuff like that. Yeah, so L337 seems like Leet speak for Leet.
So before we get to L3, you mentioned, you know, the other complicated female character who we are reunited with here.
Right, the job goes south. And so Tobias Beckett is sort of at his lowest point, although he gets over the death of his wife really, really fast.
Yeah.
He barely has time to mourn, which is fine. They have to get on with the movie. But
So we see, in terms of an origin story, this is the first time in the movie that I actually see Han Solo fly something, which is a little, you know, little bit of a thrill there, because Rio Durant, the original pilot, we mentioned the four-armed Jon Favreau CG character, gets killed, and then Han has to take the controls. He doesn't manage to get out of there with the Corellium intact, but everyone else survives. So it's a partial
coaxium intact.
Oh,
you're mixing up your imaginary substances.
What am I doing?
You've invented a new one. Right. It works just as well.
I'm gonna put me in the Wookiee hole.
Are we supposed to think that Han, this might just reveal that I've either missed something or have already forgotten something, but I found that a lot of the movie I was wondering whether Han Solo is actually like already a good pilot, or whether this is just an example of him talking a big talk, as with the rock that he claims is a thermal detonator, without actually being a great pilot yet.
That's a good question.
Like there wasn't really a payoff there. Like I was sort of left wondering, like later he is doing a, you know, when he flies the Kessel Run, he does a great job. And it was kind of unclear to me where that came from. I mean, you could see how he would have become a great driver on, you know, the planet he grew up on, where he's always hot wiring cars and stuff, like a, you know, like a young George Lucas, like he grew up drag racing cars. But I couldn't figure out how he became a great pilot, if he is indeed a great pilot.
I don't know that that's really clear. I mean, when he does take the controls, Jon Favreau is like, "Wow, you sure are a good pilot."
Right.
But it's hard to tell whether it's luck or skill. I thought most of the talk about what a great pilot he is was to build up to the joke of when he finally joins the Empire, because he's like, "I'm going to be a great pilot." And then we cut to him in the infantry. He never got his chance. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the movie wants to do this thing where it's sort of kind of simultaneously, you know, re-mythologizing and then just a little demythologizing as well. So when he does finally do the Kessel Run, which we'll talk about, but I mean, he does do it in almost 12, under 12 parsecs. They finally 14, decided they're going to round down. But also, like, he doesn't do it really fast, because he's like this amazing pilot. They have this whole encounter with this weird like gravity creature, and then they end up using just a little bit of the coaxium as like super fuel, and that shoots them out of there, and that's why they do it fast. But it's not because he flew an amazing flight. It's just they found this like kind of, they basically you know, gave it the Nas boost at the end, and that was why they got out of, you know, that's where the speed came from.
Fast and Furious in space.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to get back with Kira.
Oh, yes.
Where is Kira, which I don't know if we said, is spelled with a Q and an apostrophe.
It's these like millennials Q-I- and their space
Q
names.
Apostrophe IRA. Where is Kira, Marissa?
Okay, so the job goes south, and Tobias Beckett has to go back now and tell his super scary boss, Dryden Voss, who is the leader of, or not the leader, but a leader of a crime syndicate, Crimson Dawn, that he lost the shipment of coaxium.
And he is played by Paul Bettany with
scars.
We should describe how
face.
He looks. Yeah, he kind of looks like, I don't know, what maybe somewhere in between a human and Darth Maul, with kind of like red scars down his face, but not like full out all red and black.
Sure.
This is foreshadowing, Marissa.
Foreshadowing. Very subtle. He to me looked mostly just humanoid with scars. It wasn't as particularly creative look for him.
It was fine.
Especially knowing that the original actor cast, Michael K. Williams, was supposed to be like a half lion or something like that in motion capture. But of course, we did not get him as our villain. But we find out when Han and Chewie decide to go with Beckett back to Dryden Voss, we find out that Dryden Voss's right hand is actually Kira, Han's long lost childhood sweetheart.
And this sets up this conflict about whether Kira will, her true allegiances will be with Han, or whether she will ultimately, whether by force or by choice, remain loyal to Dryden Voss. And here is when they hatch their big plan for the second heist that will save them all, which is what, Sam?
It is the famous Kessel Run. They are, once again, they have to go to another planet that I'm going to forget the name of. But basically,
they're going to the Kessel Mines.
No, they're going, yes, so thank you.
They're like
so,
the yes, spice so they're going to, mines, yes, right?
So, well, yeah. They're mining coaxium, theoretically.
Yeah, so they're going to these mines to retrieve the coaxium. The problem with this is that it is in sort of its unrefined form. It's extremely volatile and, in fact, will blow up if they don't get it there within an insanely quick amount of time. No man can possibly find that fast. So, yeah, so they need to pick up the coaxium and get it back to Dryden Voss in a short enough time that it will not blow up and kill them all. And that is the Kessel Run.
But first, they're going to need a fast ship.
They're going to need a
Marissa, what is the origin story of Han and the Millennium Falcon?
Well, they're going to need a fast ship, and they hope to find an ally in one Lando Calrissian, played in this version by Donald Glover, who I thought was great, but I'm interested in everyone's thoughts, playing a very, like, Billy Dee Williams imitation. And in order to convince him, or at least they want to try to get the ship, Han challenges him to a game of Sabacc, and it does not end well for him.
Right. So we knew from the original movies that Han won. I believe it's in the original movies, right? That Han won the Millennium Falcon like in a bet with Lando, which kind of sets you up when they first start playing Sabacc that like, oh, this is going to be the game that Han wins. Mm. And then, in fact, he loses. But then they still team up because Lando, you know, as you put it at one point, Sam, Lando is the Solo of Solo. So Lando at this point is also kind of talking a big talk about all this stuff that he doesn't really own and such. And so he cuts a deal with them to give them the Falcon in exchange for some percentage of the whatever, phlebotinum, vibranium, MacGuffin.
Flubber.
Yeah. The flubber.
Yeah.
Okay, so out of this deal that they make with Lando, they not only get the use of the Millennium Falcon, but they also get the beloved character, new character, that we already began to discuss, who is L3. Marissa, tell us about L3.
I love L3. Probably not as much as Lando seems to love L3, since it's implied that they've had a romantic relationship. She is a droid. As in, she's a robot. It's the Star Wars equivalent of a robot, who is very into droids' rights. This is sort of an overarching question within the Star Wars universe of sort of how much are we supposed to think of droids as humans, or in some, like R2-D2 can sort of be thought of as a robot dog in a lot of ways as pets. But droids do not really have rights in the Star Wars universe. This is introduced right away in the original Star Wars when droids aren't allowed in the cantina. And L3 is just sort of an unapologetic, you know, droids deserve rights. She breaks up a droid fighting ring, or tries to, when we first meet her.
She's right, basically the Dobby of Solo.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. We learned something about how, like, her, like, loyalty programming has been disabled or something. And then also, she and Lando have a unique and maybe only mildly ambiguous relationship, but I think basically it's a romantic relationship.
Don't ask too many questions about it, but it is sort of implied. There's been some, you know, talk recently about whether or not Lando Calrissian is pansexual in this movie, which is basically not really in the movie, but now they're kind of trying to say, like, the character is anyway, which is their version of making the Star Wars universe kind of more diverse. It's just kind of telling you that characters are, even though it's not actually in the movies. But there's the implication in this movie that he has had some sort of congress with this droid.
Yeah.
Which raises a lot of questions.
Right. It's to me, it's a little weird in terms of this movie. So which creator was it of the movie who said that he's pansexual? It was like one of the screenwriters.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was in response to a direct question. Yeah. I don't think that they were going around asserting, is pansexual Lando the movie. I think it was in response to, is Lando pansexual? And they were like, sure. Yeah.
And then Donald Glover was like, well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in space to screw. And I'm like, I'm not sure that we want to think of it, but okay.
Yeah, so maybe they sort of stumbled into this. I do think it's like, it's revealing that we really get the first confirmed human droid relationship before we get the first human-human relationship where they're the same sex. Which,
I mean, seems like that could be another one of the sort of loopy Lord Miller jokes that you're just supposed to kind of knock you on your ass and not really ever explain.
Right.
Like, let's just imply that Lando and the robot had sex and then never talk about it again and just have you completely confused.
I think if you get beyond the silliness factor, though, this was a very sweet relationship. I mean, when she eventually dies, you know, quote-unquote, they sort of download her into the Millennium Falcon.
She, like, becomes part of the ship. Yeah.
I mean, you know, Donald Glover really played that seriously in his despair over losing her.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we got a true Lando L3 shipper onto the podcast.
Well, I was thrilled to see a female droid. It sounds very petty, but this idea that all of the droids in the Star Wars universe are, I mean, first of all, they're droids, so you can think of them as genderless. But sort of this idea that they have humanity and that with that can, you know, they can also be gendered. It was nice to have a woman voicing a droid for a change.
So, and we should mention that the L3's voice is done by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the creator and star of Fleabag, and also more recently of Killing Eve.
Who did not know what a droid was when she went into her audition, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't hurt. I think, is a big part of why this character is so appealing. Okay, so L3 starts a droid and Wookiee uprising, you know, around the Kessel spice mines where they're trying to get their, what are we going to call it this time? MacGuffinium. I think I may be already used. I'm not sure.
It's trending. It's catching on.
Okay. And, you know, sort of despite that and sort of because of that, I think they succeed and they bring it back to Dryden Vos. But then what happens? Sam?
Well, there are a bunch of kind of double crosses and switcheroos before them, one of which, speaking of characters being sort of unexpectedly or sort of newly female, is we find out that Enfys Nest, who has been this sort of, sort of Boba Fettish figure in this.
Masked pirate, yeah.
Yes, this sort of menacing masked pirate.
She,
I'm giving it away now, but she takes off her helmet and it turns out, you know, to be this sort of, you know, redheaded, you know, fairly young woman, which is an interesting reveal for me. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the way, I guess it's Iron Man 3 played with the character of the Mandarin,
right?
Where you kind of, you know, the presentation of the character makes you think of one thing and then the movie completely pulls that assumption out from under you. And then it also turns out that she is not, in fact, a villain, but is sort of, you know, I guess a freedom fighter of one sort or another. So then Han kind of, you know, foreshadowing or basically kind of doing again his arc from the original trilogy, ends up kind of switching allegiances and going over to her side and deciding that, in fact, they need this coaxium, Corellium.
Mm-hmm. Right. And at this
point, to feel their cause and help them fight the Empire.
And at this point, the movie basically becomes like a David Mamet movie where it's double crosses and triple crosses and who's fooling who. And I think, Marissa, I might need you to walk me through this as somebody who saw it more recently. They go and they basically plan on making Dryden Voss think that the vibranium MacGuffinium is fake, when in fact it is the real stuff.
Yes, it's very much the heist has gone terribly wrong. No, it hasn't. Yes, it has. No, yeah. It hasn't. It's
the very rare single cross.
Right. It's the double backflip, which just ends up being back.
Right. So Enfys Nest makes this passionate plea to Han to sort of flip and to Beckett as well, although Beckett decides that he's, you know, in it for himself. Beckett, who has been spending the movie saying never trust anyone, but who Han has come to sort of trust, decides that he wants to make the delivery as planned and give it to Dryden Voss. And Enfys Nest makes the plea that, you know, no, it should be used for a good cause. And so Han decides that it's revealed anyway. They bring the coaxium to Voss, but it turns out Voss has been tipped off by Beckett that they're up to no good.
Right.
So basically the audience is led to assume as well that they're bringing fake coaxium to Voss.
And Voss makes some comment about, you know, when he thinks that it's fake, he's like, wow, and it's just like an incredible mimicry. Like, you could hardly tell it from the real
thing. Yeah, that's the sort of the moment when he, like, reveals his dastardly plan. He's like, oh, I just have one question. You know, how did you make this fake thingy?
And, of course, we think Kira is the one who double-crossed Han, because that's what's implied. And then there's sort of the dramatic reveal of Beckett, like, coming from behind the doors.
Yes. Being
like, it was me the whole time.
Yeah.
Mustache twirl. But then we find out that the coaxium is real. It's not fake coaxium. This was all an elaborate setup so that Enfys Nest could ambush all of Voss's goons when they go to try to get the, quote, you know, real coaxium. But it turns out those cases are empty. Did that about sum it up?
Wow. Well, isn't there another double cross here? Because then they manage to kill Dryden Voss, and Kira basically takes over. And at the moment where we think that Kira and Han might be teaming up, Kira reveals that her true allegiance is actually to Marissa.
Dryden Voss's boss, Darth Maul, or I believe just Maul as he's called at this point.
Wow, I did not know that.
No, does
he, like,
please, ally?
He was, like, stripped of his title?
So, like, please, Sith. Darth Maul was my father.
So of course, Darth Maul is the very memorable villain from The Phantom Menace who was totally wasted on that movie.
They gave him a double-sided lightsaber and then only used it for one movie, which was a big mistake.
He's just the coolest-looking character. He was apprenticed to the Emperor, and they cut him in half at the end of the movie, and they washed their hands of it. But Darth Maul actually lives on in my beloved Star Wars animated series, The Clone Wars. He comes back, despite being cut in half, through... It's a long story. It involves talking snakes and witches and all that. But he actually... we learn that he is fueled by revenge for Obi-Wan Kenobi, who cut off his legs. He's not too happy about that. And he builds this enormous crime syndicate for himself by exploiting the underbelly of the galaxy and the fact that the Jedi are fighting a war. And so for me, this was actually not a very exciting reveal in this movie that Darth Maul is, you know, the big bad, because as soon as they said the word syndicate, I was like, oh, well, based on the timeline, I just have to assume.
So he is still cut in half, though, just
he
to be clear.
He has magic legs now.
They're like robot legs, right? It's kind of like the logical extension of the fact that Star Wars characters frequently get their arms cut off in movies and have them replaced by robot arms. Both Anakin and Luke, that happens too. And also, you get the scene at the end of Empire Strikes Back where Luke falls down this giant canyon while while having only one arm, and he survives. So I always knew, I feel like even when that movie came out, I knew that there was some possibility that Darth Maul, despite being cut in half, might similarly survive just as Luke had.
I think my question is, having done this now with Deadpool 2 last week, and this time, what movie it involves someone going getting cut in half are we going to talk about next time? So, Walk Hard.
Walk Hard.
Yeah.
The Dewey Cox story. Spoiler
special. Maul does not have creepy baby legs, for which I am very grateful. No, he's like a true Star Wars character who I'm glad they brought him into the live action movies, because I hope this will get more people interested in the Clone Wars and Rebels, where he has pretty major arcs. They also, for this movie, got Sam Witwer, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, to reprise his voice role as the character. And he does a really good job.
Right, because originally in the first movie it was Ray Park?
It's Ray Park in Solo, but the voice is being done by Sam Witwer.
Oh, okay.
Ray Park is kind of best known as a sort of stuntman who
right.
played
which
that
is
role
a nice, movie. You know, sort of synergy, bringing yes. everything together. But yes, I really hope people are interested by this and how he survived.
It's interesting. I had a slightly different reaction to that, which is it was one of a few things in this movie. And Sam, I know from your review, you felt similarly about this, where there was such a lack of closure at the end of this movie in a lot of ways that it felt less. This is like a maybe a sort of fine and tricky and somewhat self-contradictory distinction to make, but it felt less like a Star Wars movie and more like a TV episode that is kind of saying tune in for the next movie, which I say is like slightly self-contradictory because admittedly these are movies where, you know, for the first six of them, it was always called, you know, or after the first one, they were declared as episodes. And the inspiration was, you know, these like serials on TV that always did end in cliffhangers. So I don't want to complain too much about it, but I did find it a little disappointing.
There's a weird quality to me, that kind of topsy-turvy quality, to have Solo coming after The Last Jedi 6 months later, because the idea behind doing these kind of spin-off Star Wars stories is that you'd have the kind of ongoing trilogy, you know, this kind of three movies that were narratively linked to each other and very much in the vein of kind of classic Star Wars movies, and then you would have these spin-off movies, which are, you know, mostly going to be self-contained, and those would be able to, you know, we could give those to different directors and maybe even different kinds of directors who were not white men. They could be kind of different tones or styles from some of the Star Wars movies. And instead, we got The Last Jedi, which is while fitting into the chronology, is extremely different and distinct visually in some really great ways. Really feels like kind of a Rian Johnson auteur movie, even in the context of the larger story, despite the fact that it's a middle movie in a trilogy, has a very firm beginning and an end. Some people have actually said you could almost end the Star Wars series at the end of The Last Jedi and it would still be satisfying in some ways. And then you're getting these spin-off movies, which Lucasfilm and Kathleen Kennedy has been really very kind of heavy-handed in making sure that they fit into the established things. They kind of famously took Rogue One away from the director in post-production and had a lot of it rewritten and reshot by the original writer, Tony Gilroy. This one, they, you know, started even further actually in the middle of production and changed directors and seemed really at pains to make something that just feels like a Star Wars movie. So, you know, while initially we thought this was going to be kind of sort of, you know, wacky, like heist adventure that was not really kind of weighed down by the larger mythology in the way that some of the kind of mothership movies are. Instead, we've gotten something that feels really strained in its efforts to fit in with what already exists. And, you know, as you say, for it, I mean, really feels like, you know, the end of this movie is only lacking a kind of teaser for the next on Solo.
Han Solo will return.
Yes. Other than that, I mean, the ending is completely open and it's very obvious that this is meant to launch a whole new cinematic universe.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is why, you know, I was not upset about the ending of Last Jedi, or I don't recall being upset about like the ending of Empire Strikes Back, which is totally a cliffhanger. But these movies have been discussed and I believe even advertised as, quote, like standalone movies. And this is not really a standalone movie. It does not stand alone or on its own. And so I think it felt a little bit like a bait and switch
to me, even though I could see why you were more excited about it as somebody who cares more about the larger Star Wars universe outside of the main movies.
Right. I think it's worth comparing this to something like Rogue One, which was very much a closed loop.
Right.
And which literally
all the new
led...
characters, spoiler alert, die at the end of Rogue One.
Well,
and then it literally ends with the very beginning of, you know, Star Wars Episode 4, the original Star Wars movie.
Well, to me, Rogue One excelled because it introduced all these new characters and there was real emotional resonance when they died.
Right.
This movie was not precious about killing off its new characters. I mean, at the very end of the movie, Han is forced to kill Beckett and he shoots first, which is
right.
sort of the joke of the encounter. As much as I like Woody Harrelson, I wasn't broken up about Beckett's death. I didn't feel like we got to know him beyond sort of a more generic...
We're
Han
told
Solo
throughout
prototype.
The movie not to trust him. And so it's don't get too attached to this guy.
Right. I just think that this movie, it didn't really feel like it was leading anywhere to me, as opposed to Rogue One, which was very specifically leading up to, the original Star Wars, A New Hope, and explaining a little chunk of the universe. This was more sort of, here's Han Solo for 2 hours, which is fine for what it is. But I think, Rogue One was much stronger in terms of fleshing out a particular niche of the Star Wars universe.
And there was that great moment in Rogue One where you're thinking, well, okay, this is a Star Wars movie. Obviously the characters get out of it somehow, and maybe we just don't see them in the rest of the trilogy, even though they're hanging around as heroes of the Resistance somewhere. And there's that moment where I think it's Ben Mendelsohn says, close the shields or whatever. And you realize, oh shit, they're actually not getting out of this. They're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously something that's never happened in a Star Wars movie before, where they just kill the entire cast at the end of the movie. And I don't think there's any moment in Solo where you feel that. And I don't think it really does anything that hasn't been done before.
I was sure as soon as she came on screen that Kira was going to die. Mm-hmm. It was from the very beginning, as soon as we saw her, there was this big question mark over why is this woman never mentioned again, in later in Han's life. And so the assumption, the easy route would have been to kill her off. I do like that at the end of the movie, rather than, her sacrificing herself for Han or something like that, there is the implication that she lives on and becomes a crime boss.
Well, yeah, she kind of sacrifices herself in the sense that, they kill Dryden Voss and she knows that she's going to have to take his place. The first time they see each other after their separation, Han says something like, well, I'm glad to see you got out. And she just kind of, looks at him like you don't understand what the deal is. And she
I had a different reading on that. Really? I thought she was sort of waiting in the wings and poised to take his place rather than, covering his tracks or anything like that. I saw her as sort of a successor. But then again, I'm sure this will be, her character will be explored in some other form of media, whether it's one of the books or one of the TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how this movie does, given that while I think for all of history, there's been an assumption that a new Star Wars movie will, of course, make well over $1 billion, this movie has gotten more backlash before it came out than just about any Star Wars movie. I mean, I guess you'd have to go back to the second and third, to go back to the prequels.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of finding a moment in which the future of a particular branch of the Star Wars universe was so uncertain. I kind of expect that it'll still make $1 billion.
I mean, it's going to make a ton of money. I mean, and it is kind of pleasing in a very low grade way. I'm going to end up, taking my 9-year-old daughter to go see it, and I'm sure she'll be, excited to see Han and whatever else, although she's not I told her they were making, Star Wars movies that kind of explain stuff that happened before the prequels, and she was just like, why? Why would you she lives in a wonderful universe where these things don't just need to be made. But what, however much you enjoy these movies or don't, I think it is somewhat infuriating to be sitting here before the movie's even open and talking about well, maybe that'll make sense in the next movie. It's
yeah.
Can we just, which is not even announced yet, let alone scheduled. So to, only be already be talking about well, maybe this will make sense in 2 or 3 or 4 years whenever they maybe get around to shooting another one. Can we just have this movie as its own thing?
Well, we should start wrapping up soon. But the one thing I think we haven't really done is talk about, I guess, the two performances in this movie that were most anticipated. The first one being Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo, and the second one being Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian. I don't know which of you wants to take which.
But let's start with Aaron Reich as Han Solo. I found him, you know, mostly charming. There was a lot of sort of bad buzz about his performance going into this movie. And I think it's just a really hard tightrope to walk when you, and this is something I think they both struggle with a little bit, where you have to convince the audience that you are the same person that that other actor played. And so Alden Ehrenreich does the like classic Han Solo smirk a lot. And I think he pulls it off. And then other times, like, you have to do that without having it shade into outright mimicry. And I do think it sometimes feels a little bit like that. I don't know how you guys thought he pulled off that balance or not.
I thought he pulled it off maybe a little better than Donald Glover. But I also think that even though he very much is sort of Han Solo, but younger, and we don't really see as much growth, I think he convincingly pulled it off. He had his moments of beyond smirking and moments of vulnerability for the character that were beyond just, you know, Harrison Ford imitation.
Yeah, there's a sense of that his character, there's a sense at some point in this movie that his character arc is going to be, this is how, so if Han Solo is a goober who always pretends to be the swaggering hotshot rogue, that this is going to be the story of how he like learned to put up that front.
But he's already fronting.
Yeah, he's already fronting a little bit at the beginning. It's like that's an idea that they maybe sort of had but couldn't hold on
which
to it long
enough. Which
again
is the like indecisiveness in this, because I mean, yeah. Can you make a whole Han Solo movie in which Han Solo isn't Han Solo?
Right. Because it is a little frustrating sometimes when it's like, oh, he doesn't feel like Han Solo right now, especially early on in the movie. Sometimes it's like, oh, he just feels like Luke Skywalker, one of these more like dewy-eyed, you know. There's a line where it's like, he just wants to fly among the stars.
Yeah, so which somebody is like, says it to him at a point like, oh, your secret is like, you're a good man.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I think it's worth adding to that, as you were saying, that there were kind of reports that his performance was not good, and it is worth, you know, saying that those reports were pretty deliberately and obviously leaked by Lucasfilm in order to kind of, A, to give them cover in case the movie ended up being a turkey, but then also to kind of justify their decision to yank the original directors and replace them. And then there were some other stories planted more recently about like what, you know, supposed disasters Lord and Miller were on the set, and who knows, and these were all kind of anonymous crew members. So who knows how much to kind of actually credit those. But and one of the reports was that they'd hired an acting coach for Alden Ehrenreich because supposedly his performance was so disastrous. I think it's pretty good, as we're saying. I mean, I think he...
The idea of Alden Ehrenreich once again facing down an acting coach is just an image I cannot think about without thinking of the wood that it's worth for so simple. Like, literally, he became famous for a scene in which he played a bad actor,
yes,
being coached by, I guess, not technically an acting coach, but a director in Hail Caesar.
Yes. So I think he does a good job of kind of suggesting Harrison Ford without playing kind of the Muppet Babies version of him. I think Donald Glover got pushed into that. I mean, his character is just much more, the way he plays the character, and granted, this character kind of has to grow up to be Billy Dee Williams, who's like maybe the suavest person in the entire Star Wars universe. So there's a lot to live up to there, but he is playing him as kind of, I think I referred to him in the review as embryo Billy Dee Williams. I mean, he's dropped his voice about an octave and a half, and he just seems really kind of, you know, slick and sexy. And I mean, it works, you know, but it's just, it is kind of, for me, a little jarringly out of key with the rest of performances in the movie, which are not so highly stylized. I think it works because because Lando is in the movie so little.
Right.
Which is kind of, you know, as you were saying, I mean, kind of how Han functions in the original trilogy. I mean, there's not a ton of him, but he's always the person who kind of, you know, he has the kicker to the scene. He's the one who kind of comes in and everybody's like, oh, we have these lofty hopes and we're going to do these great things. And he's the one who comes in and is like, yeah, good luck, kid. So Lando kind of plays that function in this movie.
Okay. So we didn't know before seeing this movie that there is going to be some... That Disney seems to be planning some version of like Solo 2, a Star Wars Story 2. Marissa, will you go see Solo 2, a Star Wars Story 2?
I mean, yes, I will see any Star Wars movie, but I think that this one was genuinely enjoyable and I would be interested in how they would follow it up.
I think I should point out that Marissa wore Star Wars earrings to the taping, so I think that's
your earphones are covering them up.
Yeah, that's your answer right there.
I also have my BB-8 cardigan, which I don't know if I should be proud or ashamed to say is not my only Star Wars cardigan.
Sam, I mean, you are not wearing a Star Wars cardigan or Star Wars earrings.
I feel a little underdressed now, frankly. I feel like I made some bad sartorial choices this
morning. You
didn't
bring your Lando cape either.
I did not, sadly. Yeah, I can totally rock that. But yeah, no, I mean, inevitably, I will go see any and all Star Wars movies. I mean, I quite literally grew up with these things. I mean, the first movie came out when I was 3. They've been a part of my entire life. I now have a child who I've gotten into them and is excited for them. And I will, you know, for better or for worse, I am the sucker who will keep seeing them as long as they keep putting them out. So yes, I will keep seeing Star Wars movies. I may grow increasingly resentful of them if more of them are like Solo, but Disney has my money regardless.
Yeah, I mean, it's really frustrating to me that I will also see any Star Wars movie that's made, at least at the current rate at which they're made, like not only because it is basically all of our jobs to see see these movies, we should say, but also because I would be seeing them even if I was in a different job. I think, and so that's frustrating to me because it takes all pressure off Disney to actually make good movies. I think the only thing I can say is I'm definitely not going to see the Star Wars movie again. You know, I saw Force Awakens multiple times in the theater. I saw The Last Jedi multiple times in the theater. I think that was maybe partly for my job, but definitely not all for this job. This movie, I'm definitely not going to see again in the theater. And so I think that is the only bit of, like, take that, Disney, I can say.
I just like
I'm only
so going to
see
it
once.
Yeah. Take that.
Well, I will go by myself, you guys.
You're going to see it again?
I'll see this again.
I got a kid to take, so I'm going to see it again. But, you know, perhaps I will let my mind drift.
All right. Well, there's no hope for any of us because we all see Star Wars movies multiple times, whether they're good or not. All right.
We are the problem, basically. Sorry.
All right. Well, I suppose I look forward to talking about this again when we get the next mediocre Solo movie. Hopefully it'll be better than mediocre. Marissa, I hope you'll come back. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Forrest.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Please subscribe to the Slate Spoilers Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. For Sam and Marissa, I'm Forrest Wickman. Thanks for listening.